Yashodanandana Rajajanaranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Fifth Canto, Chapter 20, starting with Text 23. Title of the chapter, Structure of the Universe. Oh, we're on 24. That's right. Okay, 24. These are in prose, so we'll just read the translation and purports. Probably a few verses. Text 24, translation. Outside the ocean of milk is another island, Shakadvipa, which has a width of 3,200,000 yojanas, or 25,600,000 miles. As Kranchadvipa is surrounded by its own ocean of milk, Shakadvipa is surrounded by an ocean of churned yogurt, as broad as the island itself. In Shakadvipa, there's a big shaka tree, from which the island takes its name. This tree is very fragrant. Indeed, it lends its scent to the entire island. Text 25. The master of this island, also one of the sons of Priyavrata, was known as Medhatiti. He also divided his island into seven sections, named according to his names, to the names of his own sons, whom he made the kings of that island. The names of those sons are Purojava, Manojava, Pavamana, Dumranika, Chitrarepa, Bahurupa, and Vishadhara. After dividing the islands and situating his sons as its rulers, Medhatiti personally retired, and to fix his mind, completely on the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he entered a forest suitable for meditation. Text 26. For these lands also, there are seven boundary mountains and seven rivers. The mountains are Ishana, Urushringa, Malabhadra, Shatakesara, Sahasrasrata, Devapala, and Mahanasa. The rivers are Anagha, Arurda, Abhayasprishti, Aparajita, Panchapadi, Sahasruti, and Nijatruti. Text 27. The inhabitants of those islands are also divided into four castes: Ritavrata, Satyavrata, Danavrata, and Anuvrata, which exactly resemble Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. They practice pranayama and mystic yoga, and in trance they worship the Supreme Lord in the form of Vayu. And text 28. Anta pravishya bhutani yo vibhartyatmake tuve antaryamishvara sakshat patu no yad vashes putam. The inhabitants of Shakadvip worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the form of Vayu in the following words: O Supreme Person, situated as the super soul within the body, you direct the various actions of the different airs, such as prana, and thus you maintain all living entities. O Lord, O Supersoul of everyone, O Controller of the cosmic manifestation, under whom everything exists, may you protect us from all dangers. Purport. Through the mystic yoga practice called pranayama, the yogi controls the airs within the body to maintain the body in a healthy condition. In this way, the yogi comes to the point of trance and tries to see the Supersoul within the core of his heart. Pranayama is the means to attain samadhi, trance, in order to fully absorb oneself in seeing the Supreme Lord as Antaryami, Antaryami, the super soul within the core of the heart. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gnanjana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishnam Stapitam Yena Bhutve Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vanchakalpaturubhyascha kripa sindhubhya eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Okay, so we're on the island of Shakadvip now. So we're continuing our discussion of different residents of different areas of the universe offering prayers to different forms of the Lord. And now we're in this island of Shakadvip. And the residents in this particular region of the universe, they mostly practice mystic yoga, particularly through the process of pranayama. And the goal that we hear of, like Ashtanga yoga, or this mystic yoga process, Prabhupada says here in the purport that the goal is samadhi, or trance. And the residents of these, the residents of this particular island, they try to reach the state of samadhi by through the process of pranayama. So, anyway, for those of you who were here in 2011 for the Christmas retreat, Mother Donna Kayla gave this really amazing class on samadhi. What is it? How we can attain it, the different methods of attaining it, and it was very nice. So pretty much everything I know about this topic comes from that lecture. So I thought I'd just speak a little bit about samadhi, how it relates to this verse, and how we try to also attain samadhi. So samadhi is defined as uninterrupted, unstoppable absorption in meditation on the name, the form, the qualities, and pastimes of Krishna. This is how we can understand what is samadhi, uninterrupted. And why does it why is it important for samadhi to be uninterrupted? Why is that the goal? So, because we hear that in Bhagavad Gita, whatever subject matter that attracts the mind of a dying man becomes the beginning of his next life. So what happens if one of those interruptions in our meditation on Krishna just happens to fall in those weeks or those days or those hours or seconds where we happen to leave the body? What happens if we're not constantly remembering Krishna? Then it's very likely that at the time of death we're not going to remember Krishna, and therefore we're not going to achieve the goal. So we hear that there's two main methods for achieving samadhi. One is the ascending method, and the other is the descending method. So the ascending method, which is also kind of highlighted here in the purport of this verse, is where through one's own aptitudes, one's own abilities, one's own qualification, through one's endeavor, one progresses through the stages of Krishna meditation all the way up to the point of samadhi. So it's you're trying to ascend to this state of samadhi, of constant remembrance of Krishna. And the other method is the descending method, where one tries to, where one receives mercy of Krishna. And by receiving mercy, then one can remember Krishna. So the example given to help us understand this is that of the baby monkey and the baby kitten. So the baby monkey, in order for the baby monkey to get from point A to point B, it has to hold on to the chest of the mother in order to be able to travel. So it's through the baby monkey's own strength that he's holding on to the mother, and therefore he's able to go from point A to point B. So this is compared to the ascending process. And then there's the example of the baby kitten, which is compared to the descending process. The kitten, in order for the kitten to go from point A to point B, the mother just comes and picks up the kitten by the neck and then drags him and puts him to the next location. So the kitten is completely surrendered. He's not doing anything on his own to move to the next point. So this is considered to be the descending process. So sometimes we tend to think that here in the Krishna consciousness movement, that we as devotees, that we tend to practice the descending method primarily. And that Ashtanga yogis, like the yogis in this particular region of the universe, they're guilty of being in the ascending mode. You know, through their rigid practices of pranayama and whatever, sense control and everything, that they're trying to reach samadhi through that way, but we don't do that. We practice the descending method. However, we see that even if we are practicing bhakti yoga, we see that we can also be guilty of practicing the ascending method, or being in the ascending mode, we're gonna crash the gates of Vaikuntha or something. You know, I'm gonna memorize verses, I'm gonna meditate on the deity form, Krishna, and I'm gonna try to always think of Krishna. So I'm gonna remember Krishna. So this is one mentality that devotees can sometimes get into. The problem with that is that it's not always likely going to work out that way. Because the idea is that intelligence is defined in, there's three aspects to intelligence. One aspect is being knowledgeable, knowing so many things. Another aspect is the ability to store information or memory, to have a good memory. And then the third aspect is one's analytical abilities. You can analyze different things. So if we're relying on our own intelligence to come to the point of samadhi, many of us are going to be in big trouble because, you know, some of us just don't have good memories or that very strong analytical abilities, or we don't have that great of an intelligence. So if we're relying on that to come to samadhi, then it's a hopeless endeavor. What to speak of if, you know, as you get older, you start to experience, you know, signs of forgetfulness, you get dementia and Alzheimer's and different things that impede our ability to remember things. Or if we get into like a car accident and we get some brain damage or something. And so like that, just immediately our own qualifications, we don't have any. So we're most likely not going to make to the goal of samadhi. So that's why we stress so much on the descending method, as we recommend this, the descending approach. And it's helpful for us devotees to really learn this art of this descending method. Because it's very easy for us to get into this mentality that I'm going to do it. This doership mentality comes up very easily in spiritual life, that I'm going to remember Krishna. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that from him comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So it's actually only from Krishna that we were able to remember him. But we see in our, like if many of us are working or students or something, we're forced to remember all these things that we might not want to remember. Like if we're a student, like I majored in engineering, so I'd memorize a lot of formulas and equations and theorems and everything. So I'd use my memory to learn this stuff, and I'd force myself to memorize it. So we should also, in one sense, endeavor to use our materially conditioned mind to try to remember Krishna. Endeavor must be there. You know, we should try to memorize verses and meditate on the deities and, you know, and so on and so forth. But that endeavor is only half the equation. So to illustrate this point, there's this popular example of the sparrow. So one time there's this little sparrow who happened to lay her eggs near the beach. And the nature of sparrows and her eggs is that the sparrow goes away for some time and then comes back to the eggs and then keeps coming and going. And then one time when the sparrow was away from the eggs, the ocean, there's like this wave and came and took the eggs. And then the ocean kind of took the eggs back into the ocean. So when the sparrow returned, she was really distraught. And she thought that, she figured out that the ocean took her eggs. So the sparrow confronted the ocean saying, "Hey ocean, you took my, give me back my eggs right now. You know, if you don't give me back my eggs, then I'm going to drink you up." You know, so this is obviously what can a little sparrow do to a gigantic ocean? You know, how much water can you put in the beak of a sparrow? Like a quarter of a milliliter or something? You know, so obviously, the ocean didn't respond. But then the sparrow, though, was very, very determined. So the sparrow started to, you know, peck away one drop of water at a time, you know, trying to drink up the ocean. And then the sparrow kept doing this and kept doing this to the point of thorough exhaustion. And when Garuda, who's like the king of the birds, when he saw his little descendant there being so determined to drink up this ocean, this attracted the attention of Garuda, and he came personally. And then when he came, he told the ocean that, "Ocean, you better give back this sparrow her eggs, otherwise I will drink you up." And then the ocean could understand, wow, this is a bird who actually could drink me up. So then the ocean gave back the eggs. So the idea here is that the Lord helps those who help themselves. And the Lord doesn't help those who don't help themselves. Nor does the Lord fail to help those who help themselves. So we should endeavor. We should, you know, strive to remember Krishna. But we should understand that really it's the Lord who's going to make it possible. So there's so that that's the importance of the descending approach. Sometimes, therefore, our endeavor should be to remember Krishna, but in order to be able to remember Krishna, there's a specific aspect of our endeavor which we need to work on. And that endeavor which we need to work on primarily is our endeavor of prayer. So this is actually the essential component of our endeavor. We hear that we should pray as though, or we should work as though the results depend on our endeavor, but we should pray knowing fully well that the results depend on Krishna's mercy. So Prabhupada nicely demonstrated this one time when he's on a morning walk with his disciples, and he asked his disciples, you know, what is the difference between you and me? And his disciples thought, well, there's lots of things that are different between you and me. So they all started answering in different ways, but they weren't saying what Prabhupada wanted. So Prabhupada said, the difference between you and me is that you can fall into Maya and I cannot. So the devotees were like, right, good answer, you know, yeah, okay. So the devotees accepted that. So then after the morning walk was over, they came to greet the deities. And when Prabhupada was greeting the deities and he was offering his prayers, he offered his prayers with such intense emotion, and like he was fervently praying something. The other devotees were noticing that he's praying very intensely, and then, you know, tears were coming, and the devotees were like, one particular devotee was really wondering, well, I wonder what Prabhupada is praying. What is he saying? How does he pray? So after the morning program was over, he went to go see Prabhupada, and he asked Prabhupada, you know, I want to know, I saw that you were praying so intensely when greeting the deities. I was wanting to know, what were you praying? I want to learn how to pray. So Krishna, Prabhupada said that, well, I was just praying to Radha and Krishna to plead, you know, that may I not fall into Maya and forget you. So the devotee happened to be there on the morning walk, and he thought, wait, I thought you just told us this morning that the difference between us and you is that we can fall into Maya, but that you cannot. So why is it that you were praying? Or, you know, so how do you explain that? And then Prabhupada said, yes, and now you know why. Because Prabhupada is always constantly praying that may I not fall into Maya and forget you. And this is why he's not going to fall into Maya, whereas others will, because they're not praying like this. So Prabhupada showed by his own example this, how unless the heart is desperately calling out, you know, their heart is in this condition of desperate prayer and begging for the mercy of Krishna, begging to be able to remember him, especially at the time of death, then nothing's probably going to happen by our own efforts. So daily our prayer should be, my dear Radha and Krishna, please engage me in your loving devotional service and give me the privilege of remembering you. Because, you know, being able to remember Krishna is a privilege. So when we speak of remembrance or being able to remember Krishna, what is it? What does that exactly mean? Because we hear sometimes that in order to go back to Godhead, all you have to do is just remember Krishna. You know, that sounds easy. Oh, Krishna, you know, okay, you know, you can go back to Godhead. But then again, we also hear that in order to go back to Godhead, one needs to be perfect. You need to be completely pure in order to go back to Godhead, which seems impossible. So which is it? So the idea is that it's not an academic kind of remembrance of Krishna which is being referred to. You know, sometimes people, when they join the Hare Krishna movement, they always wonder, why do we have to follow these four regulative principles and all these rules and regulations and stuff. It seems like I could remember, Krishna, if I smoke a cigarette or if I drink a beer or something. I mean, it's not that I'm going to think, oh, you know, Krishna, who? Oh, I completely forgot everything. You know, I mean, likely you're still going to be able to at least have some academic memory of Krishna. That's granted. But the kind of memory or remembrance that is being referred to the kind of remembrance that's required in order to go back to Godhead is samadhi, which we defined earlier as uninterrupted, unstoppable absorption and meditation on Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. So this is the kind of remembrance we're speaking of. And in order to be able in that state of samadhi at the time of death, one needs to start practicing being in samadhi now. So there's a whole formula for how to get to the state of samadhi and from the descending approach. So the mechanism from the descending approach is that it's not that the devotee puts the Lord in his heart and, you know, tries to remember Krishna by putting the Lord in his heart, but rather it's that the Lord chooses to manifest himself in the heart of a devotee. So there's this nice example in one of Prabhupada's prayers that he wrote on the boat ride over from India to America on the Jaladuta. He wrote this prayer called Prayer at the Lotus Feet of Lord Krishna. And in it there's this one line that says, today, remembrance of you came to me in a very nice way. Because I had a great longing, I called for you. So this is how Prabhupada prayed. He didn't say that, oh, today I remembered you. He said, you know, because I had a great longing, therefore I called to you. And when I did that, remembrance of you came. You came to me. It's not that I remembered you, but you came to me. So this Prabhupada is showing us that, you know, it's not like we, when we're chanting japa or something, it's not that we artificially try to imagine Krishna when we're chanting japa. It's not that we surround ourselves with pictures of Krishna and try to remember Krishna while we're like that, while we're chanting japa. But rather it's that when one chants offenselessly, when one chants pure, Krishna will manifest himself in the heart and it'll be a very natural thing. You'll just automatically be seeing Krishna. So the question is, when is Krishna going to manifest in our heart? And when Krishna manifests in our heart, it's a permanent thing. It's not, you know, once he's there, he's there. It's like a permanent fixture. So when is that going to come, when Krishna is going to manifest in our heart? And the answer is that when the heart is squeaky clean. So that means that our endeavor has to be in earnestly striving to go through the process of anartha nivritti. So we do the process of anartha nivritti, trying to remove unwanted things from the heart. And then Krishna will see our striving to do so, and then he will, you know, manifest himself. He will reciprocate. Because our heart is meant for the pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Right now we're not using our heart for that purpose. So we're kind of like thieves in a sense, because we're using something which is meant for a certain purpose in the service of somebody else. So we're actually like thieves right now. But that's it. That's how our Krishna can manifest in our heart. There's no other qualification necessary. The only qualification is to have a clean heart, not to be able to memorize so many verses or whatever. So anybody has that ability to do that. Well, then one can ask, well, how does our heart get clean? So our heart gets clean when we mold our life in such a way that we will always be able to remember Krishna. So we mold our life. So molding our life in such a way means that we mold our life such that our heart becomes uncluttered. You know, they say that the cluttered desk is the sign of a cluttered mind. So, you know, sometimes we hear devotees of, you know, doing hours and hours and hours of sadhana every day, but then you go visit their home or their room or their locker or something, and you see that, wow, everything is very disorganized and dirty and all over the place. So, you know, so we need to arrange our life in such a way that we can, our consciousness can become spotlessly clean. And in order to do that, we really have to simplify our life. And that's really the only way it's going to be possible. So we practice the KISS formula. KISS stands for keep it simple, stupid. You know, so just we want to simplify as much as possible. Because the best way to simplify our life is to simplify our consciousness. And we simplify our consciousness by following Rupa Goswami's principles in the Nectar of Instruction. You know, doing the six things that are favorable for remembering Krishna and avoiding the six things that are not favorable for remembering Krishna. So we should be patient, enthusiastic, determined. We should follow the rules properly. We should associate with devotees and be greedy for devotional service. Those are favorable for remembering Krishna. And we should avoid those things that inhibit our remembrance, you know, of like talking unnecessarily, over-collecting things, or overeating, or having bad association, striving for things which are very difficult to achieve, and not following the rules and regulations properly, you know, like that. So, you know, it might not seem connected, but it's connected. So one might say, well, golly, I've been practicing devotional service for umpteen years, and I don't see any signs of samadhi in my life. You know, maybe Krishna's not pleased with me or something. You know, what's wrong? I've been, you know, bent over backwards serving so much. You know, what does a person have to do to get to the stage of samadhi? So the problem there lies in, you know, we often have this experience. So the problem lies in our conception of devotional service. So right now we falsely think that I am the subject and Krishna is the object. So we have this conception of devotional service, like, oh, I cooked for the deities today, or I distributed Prabhupada's books or something. And you notice who's the subject in these sentences? It's I. And with that, that's not clean consciousness, because the actual fact is that Krishna is the subject and we're his objects. So it's rather, instead of I cook for the deities, it's, well, Krishna used me as an instrument to cook for him. Or instead of I distributed Prabhupada's books, it's, you know, Prabhupada used me as an instrument to hand books to people or something. So this is clean consciousness. This is, if we always have this consciousness that Krishna is the subject and we are the object, and we keep practicing this, you know, throughout our lives and in our daily lives, then Krishna can't help but manifest in our heart, because our heart is clean at that point. So we can pray, you know, if we're in front of Kishore Kishore, you say, my dear Kishore Kishore, you know, there's like 10, 15 people in this room, you know, choose me. Choose me to cook for you today, or choose me to sing for you, or whatever. So, you know, choose me. So that way we become the object and Krishna is the subject, because he's the one who's choosing us as the object. It's like a hammer or a screwdriver, you know. So like a hammer or a screwdriver, when, you know, when the carpenter builds a chair or a piece of furniture or something, the hammer doesn't think that I built this chair. The hammer thinks that, oh, it's only because of the mercy of the carpenter that I was used to help build this chair. And if it wasn't for this carpenter, I might be rusting away in some toolbox or something and not being used. And who knows, 20 years could come by and I could be thrown away. You know, so it's really by the mercy of the carpenter that I'm able to do anything. So this is clean consciousness. This is what this can help us to get to that state of always being able to remember Krishna. Samadhi. So that's, I would recommend hearing that lecture. That's, you know, it's very nice. Today is also the appearance of Lord Vrahadev. So we still have some time, so I guess we can speak a little bit about Lord Vrahadev. Chayanishabhuva the other day described the pastime of Lord Vraha, the Sunday feast. So Lord Vraha, most of us are familiar with him in the pastime. So about 2 billion years ago, the earth was underwater, according to the Vedas. And Lord Brahma, he asked his son Svayambhuva Manu to, you know, again populate the earth. Svayambhuva Manu told Brahma, well, Brahma, how am I supposed to do that? The earth is underwater right now, so how am I supposed to populate the earth? So Brahma thought about it for a while, and he also was perplexed, so he was just appealing to the Lord. And when he was thinking that way, this little flying boar came out of his nose, his nostril, and it was started as the size of a thumb, and then immediately expanded to be this very, very large boar. So this phenomenon of increasing one's size, we see this, it's a certain kind of mystic city called Mahima. And this Mahima city is an Anima city, which is also contraction, you know, making yourself smaller. It's used throughout the Vedas, you know. So we hear descriptions how in the heavenly planets, the demigods, they're on a whole nother scale of size than here on the earth. They're much larger. Everything there is much larger. So when the demigods come here and visit planet Earth, they kind of shrink their size in order to be able to relate with entities here on Earth. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to relate because the size difference is just so huge. And the best example of this is when Krishna and Arjuna went to go see Mahavishnu. You know, they traveled to the edges of the universe and passed through the coverings of the universe, and they went to go see Mahavishnu, Krishna and Arjuna. And you think about the size of the universe and how tiny we are here on planet Earth, and imagine Mahavishnu through whom so many universes are expanding. So the size difference between Mahavishnu and us here on planet Earth is very, very great. But when Krishna and Arjuna went to go see Mahavishnu, they were able to speak with him, meaning they were able to relate with him therefore they must have grown in size. So it's a very natural phenomenon that occurs throughout the Vedic literatures. So, you know, okay, so then, you know, Lord Vraha expanded him. He's this big, big hog now. He dives into the waters of devastation, and he lifts up the earth and puts it back into its right place. So we can ask the question, well, what is the ocean that the earth fell into? Because from our modern scientific understanding of the universe and the earth, we don't see any big ocean or something that the earth can fall into. All we see is empty space and this little earth planet. So it doesn't make sense from a modern scientific view that the earth can fall into the ocean. So this sounds like a very extraordinary claim. And one way that we can understand, that we can appreciate these extraordinary claims in the Vedas is to realize that they're actually more extraordinary than we thought. So we can expand our framework of reference so as to accommodate what is actually being said. So in the case of the earth falling into this waters of devastation, it's not the earth globe that falls into this, to the ocean. It's the whole plane of Bhumandala. So the ocean, you know, often, you know, we kind of, there's this picture of Lord Varaha with, you know, with a little globe on his tusk. So again, many of us have the misconception that Lord Varaha lifted just this little planet Earth, you know, the globe planet. And this is actually not the case. Lord Varaha actually lifted Bhumandala, which happens to be about 4 billion miles in diameter. And, you know, the universe itself is 4 billion miles in diameter, and the plane of Bhumandala is a little bit less than that. There's a gap between the edge of the plane of Bhumandala and the edges of, and the edge of the universe. There's like 13.6 million miles. So because of this gap, it makes sense for the plane of Bhumandala to be able to fall. Because if the plane of Bhumandala was the same diameter as the diameter of the universe, then there would be nowhere for that Bhumandala to fall to, because it'd be rigidly bolted in the side of the universe. And therefore, it makes sense for the Ananta Dev to hold up the Bhumandala on his hoods and for elephants to balance it and everything. So that way we've now expanded our framework of reference so that we can accommodate the fact that Bhumandala can fall into the waters of devastation. Another, when we think about these extraordinary claims in the Bhagavatam, also considering the structure of the universe and different explanations, we can also, what helps us is understanding higher dimensional space. So a lot of the descriptions that we see in the Bhagavatam are not confined to just the three dimensions that we see every day. And the best example, a good example to help illustrate this is the description of beings with many arms and many heads. So we see like Banasura, this great demon, he had 1,000 arms. I assume there's 500 on this side and 500 on this side. And with these 1,000 arms, he operated 500 bows, and he was able to fire them all simultaneously. Or we hear Ravana, who has 10 heads. So artists sometimes have difficulty depicting Ravana, because how are you going to fit 10 heads on a body? It's not so easy. So a lot of the depictions, they'll show like a head stringed out into some empty space in the canvas. And, you know, so artists have difficulty. They have difficulty representing it in three dimensions, let alone two dimensions. So one way that we can, so if we just look at three dimensions, it's practically impossible to understand how we can have 500 arms on each shoulder, you know, each side of the torso, because, you know, they would just get in each other's way. It just wouldn't physically be possible in three dimensions. And let's say they had somehow the ability that each arm and each bow could somehow pass through each other, so they wouldn't be in each other's way, and they were all fired in the same direction, and that so all the arrows, they were also able to pass through each other. Then why wouldn't the arrows pass through the bowstring? You know, because if everything could pass through each other, then they wouldn't be able to fire anything. So it makes no sense in three dimensions. But when we consider higher dimensions, like four dimensions and so forth, we can't imagine, but we can at least understand that it's possible for two arms to come out from one torso, like from one shoulder, and have free range of motion, and without getting in each other's way, because one's in another dimension than the other. And like that, if you just increase the number of dimensions, you could have 500 arms on one side of the body, and therefore they can all fire in the same direction without being in each other's way. So this can help us to somewhat understand higher dimensional. So a lot of the descriptions of the Bhagavatam, they're not in our realm of perception, in our domain of experience. a lot of the things we read about, although, you know, there's many realities going on that we can't perceive just because our senses are limited. But our senses can be altered so that we can actually see other domains of experience. So Krishna, best example of this is when Krishna gave Arjuna the eyes to see the universal form. So Arjuna was in one place, and Krishna gave him the vision to see the universal form, basically everything, everywhere, all in one place. You know, unlimited arms and legs, and it's described that the effulgence of this form was brighter than 1,000 suns rising simultaneously. So if with our current eyes, if we were to see the sun, just one sun, we would become blind. But Krishna, you know, Arjuna was able to see the whole universal form because Krishna gave him the vision to do so. Because the reality was going on there, but he just couldn't see it with his limited vision. So like that, we can change our vision. So anyway, those are just some thoughts on the pastime of Lord Rahadev and Samadhi. Is there anything anyone would like to add? All right. Microphone's not over there. It's okay. Yeah, Curtis. The universe is shaped like a giant sphere. It's called Undagola. It's a sphere egg. So the diameter of the universe is 4 billion miles. Or, 500,000 yojanas. And a yojana is about 8 miles. And then there's, right now we're we're going through the description of Bhumandala, which is the circular disk in this, roughly about the center of the universe. We're in this center island of this disk, this plane of Bhumandala. And this center island's about 800,000 miles. And then there's a ring of, it's surrounded by an island, which also has the width of 800,000 miles. And then it's described that each concentric island and ocean going outwards to the edge of the universe is like double the distance from the previous one. And so if you do the math, the diameter of Bhumandala is a little less than 4 billion miles. Okay, anything else? Okay, now I guess we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Prabhupada Ki.